I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Raptors Over Everything podcast. I'm your host, William Liu. I'm joined on this episode to talk in depth about Fred VanVleet and Pascal Siakam with Blake Murphy. First of all, Blake, you have the honor of being the first ever guest of this pod.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Damn, I'm honored.
I had to start from the bottom and move to the top.
Wow. Wow. After me, where does it go from here? You get Wolstad and then Lewenberg and then Doug?
Yeah, I've got to work my way up to Doug, you know.
Yeah, he'll have a book to promote soon, so.
Blake, how you doing, man? How you doing? This is the question I got to ask everybody. Are you holding up okay, everything like that?
Yeah, man. I think, like, you know, obviously there are bad days and there are lulls in the energy or the motivation or optimism or whatever, but in relative terms, like, I'm healthy, I'm still employed, my family's healthy, so trying to maintain that perspective above everything else and just try to stay occupied, keep trying to come up with this content.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't have time to read it yet because I've spending basically the last 2 days looking just at Fred VanVleet and Pascal Siakam stories for this podcast, but you just dropped a whole love ballot for Jose Calderon.
Yeah, man.
If I'm not mistaken, didn't you name your dog after Jose Calderon?
Yeah. It was like Jose Calderon and Jose Bautista. Like, Calderon was wrapping up and Bautista was coming up, and it was just kind of a good confluence of factors. But yeah, they had like sent around a thing that was like, hey, this week we want a bunch of athletic writers to highlight their favorite players or the stories about their favorite players or whatever. And like, if I'm being like 100% honest, like, Lowry is the guy that I've enjoyed the most as a Raptor fan over the years. But I had like a pretty good attachment to Calderon because right around the time he was coming up, I found out that I have like a Spanish grandfather that I didn't know about. And I'm like a chunk Spanish. That was like kind of right as my Raptor fandom was picking up too. So he'll always be my guy.
After you found out about these, your ancestry results, did Herbie start pronouncing your name differently, or were you Blake Murphy?
Yeah.
After this,
no, we changed the. I'll go back to using Edward, and it'll be Eduardo instead.
Oh, okay.
I'll use my my maternal grandfather's last name, Marquez.
Oh, whoa!
Yeah.
All right. Damn.
We'll do a full rebrand.
Yeah, I can't wait, man.
If Marc Gasol re-signs long term, I'll do this, and I'll be his guy.
Yeah, they're going to give you the Christopher Columbus treatment?
Ooh.
Just turning an Italian man straight up into a... Anyway, so we're going to talk about Fred and Pascal. I did a podcast last week that was focused a lot on Kyle. It ran really long. Shout out Iman for helping me out with that. And my idea was sort of to do the same thing with Fred and Pascal because they've also had a really good career. But there's a bit of news item that I want to get to before we talk first about Fred and then about Pascal. So over the weekend, there was a report that came out from Woj that the Bulls are looking to hire. It's actually not entirely clear what the role is, but basically they want a new decision maker to replace the guard pack situation. And apparently Bobby Webster was among four main candidates that the Bulls had identified as someone who could target. Now, right before coming onto the show, Michael Grange of Sportsnet dropped a report saying that the Raptors are most likely going to tell the Bulls to not F off, but just like, look, this is not a good time.
Yeah, and, seriously.
Well, first off, not a good time for anything, all right? But second of all, not a good time because there's also the uncertainty with Masai's contract. And in that Grange report, he also notes that Masai apparently had some preliminary conversations in February with MLSC about sort of an extension. But apparently Larry Tannenbaum apparently had surgery, and then George Cope was out of the country. And so those conversations kind of ended there for that the time being. Right now, everybody's contract ends in 2021. And to me, I think it'd be... You can't let Bobby go if you don't have Masai sort of locked in. What are your thoughts on this situation?
Yeah, let me just say, first of all, with respect to Granger's report about Masai's negotiations, color me just shocked that as all this stuff about Masai not having an extension in place got leaked, then suddenly MLSE came to the table. It's crazy how that whole cycle works in that exact order, and I can't at all tell who was leaking that information now.
Wow.
Certainly not. But no, I think you're right. You know, I think, first of all, for anyone who doesn't know, this is a situation where the Raptors don't have to grant the Bulls permission necessarily. There are reasons sometimes an organization would want to. You know, you want a good reputation around the league as someone who treats their employees well, and if there's an opportunity for promotion, you kind of let them go. Shortly after Jeff Weltman became the GM and Masai elevated to president, the Magic obviously came calling. They offered Weltman the president position, so that's a promotion, not a lateral move, and the Magic had to pay a second-round pick to kind of make that happen. I'd imagine that, you know, if Webster came to the Raptors and was like, look, the Bulls are offering me the presidency, and I'd like out of my deal 1 year early, it would be a similar situation where, you know, it sucks, but send some picks our way to make it worthwhile. You know, I don't know if you get that top 8, top 10 pick the Bulls are looking at for the 2020 draft, but you might get something back. But I don't know if it'll even get that far. You know, like, I think Webster's a guy who is ready to run his own shop. I'm incredibly, you know, I don't know what the word is for him for it, but, you know, I think he's really smart, and I think he's ready to run his own shop. I think the Bulls would be a fun challenge for an exec, because even though the organization's been messy, it's not quite as bad as like a Knicks situation. It's still a pretty big market, and, you know, one of those things where, hey, if you help fix the Bulls, your legacy is pretty bulletproof at that point. You know, they're a little on the cheap side, but that might suit Bobby too, since he's like a salary cap loophole kind of guy and cut like $18 million from the Raptors luxury tax bill while adding for the championship team last year. So maybe that's a challenge he likes. But no, I don't think, you know, I'd need to see more smoke before I got too worried about this. The list of people that the Bulls leaked that they were interested in interviewing was basically four of the most well-respected lieutenants around the NBA. So basically the Bulls put out there that we want to hire the best person. So I think, you know, you have an idea where that's coming from and that they're trying to set a tone as they begin this search. But yeah, I would need things to pick up a little bit more before I get too worried about Webster going, both because the year left on his contract and because the weird timing and everything here. You know, it is an interesting question. Longer term, would, you know, say MLSE got an extension done with Masai right now, and the Bulls offered Bobby full control on the president role, you know, does he go then? Because that's a good challenge, and that's a chance to run his own shop. And if, you know, Ujiri's around longer term, maybe he doesn't get that here. But that's, I think, a couple steps past where we're at right now.
Yeah, for sure. You know, looking ahead, strictly speaking, obviously, we've already talked about the situation. Just looking ahead, though, if the Raptors were to lose Bobby one day, because it does seem like, as you mentioned, you know, he's ready to take that next step. He's one of the most highly regarded. I think he's already GM, but I mean, like, you know, nowadays, I guess president is above GM. So, you know, he's already one of the most highly regarded guys. And even Masai has talked about how, you know, look, he's going to run a team one day.
Oh, yeah.
And if, you know, in that situation, if that does come and Masai is still here, what does a potential succession plan look like?
Well, look, for as fond as I am of Webster, you know, I think that what has happened during this run is, like, obviously there is just a world of credit to go around for everyone in the Raptors organization, right? They have a really deep front office, and that's a huge part of their strength. But Dan Tolsman, like, you know that I'm going to say this, Dan Tolsman does not get enough love, I don't think, for his role in this. You know, not only was he kind of the first person in charge of the 905 and setting that whole system up and making sure it was a cohesive thing with the NBA Raptors, which we're obviously going to talk about a lot today, talking about Fred and Pascal, you know, Tolsman's one of their top scouting guys and one of their top kind of talent identification guys, in addition to being a player development guy. You know, he's someone who, Terrence Davis is someone he was high on, a Fred VanVleet is someone he was really high on. So I think, you know, Tolsman has been in the AGM role a couple years now. He's been in the front office a while. He has, obviously, a relationship with Masai dating back to Denver. I think if Bobby were to go, that'd probably be the move. Promote from within and then just make sure, you know, you're working aggressively to backfill that spot somewhere in the organization. You know, I think there are a couple people under Tolzman who would then slide up a rung, whether that's Chad Sanders or Isaac Lax, or maybe Teresa Rasch or Shelby Weaver take on more on the front office side instead of the operations side. You know, there are more people in place in the organization. But I think, you know, the immediate move would be Tolzman to GM. And I'm honestly a little surprised that as we've started to hear rumblings about Webster and there's obviously the Ujiri stuff, I'm pretty surprised that that hasn't extended down as far as Tolzman yet, who would conceivably be easier to poach because you'd be poaching him for a promotion. And then, you know, the Raptors might be a little more willing to play ball on something like that. You know, last summer, I remember being pretty surprised that the Suns, Tolzman is an Arizona guy, I was surprised that he wasn't a name that came up in their search. So, you know, that's another guy within the organization that's been around through this entire run and I think is probably ready to bite off a little bit more, you know, not to the same level of Webster in terms of being a president, running your own shop, but I think he could probably step into that GM role if it came to that.
All right. Well, I mean, that's reassuring. And look, this is very fitting with the theme of this podcast, which is about development. Like, you know, there's a pipeline for everything with the Raptors. And so moving over to Fred and Pascal. First off, the two of them come into the draft together, 2016. Now, obviously, Fred, who's the guy we're going to talk about first, goes undrafted. I mean, this story's been told many times, but I think it's worth revisiting because I think, you know, just going undrafted and stuff like that, it's like, you know, you go undrafted, but you do have some options. Like, you know, Fred did have some, you know, second round offers. But the thing is, he would have had to play in the D League at the time. He would have made like, what, $20K a year to play in the D League, and the chances weren't good. So he decides to bet on himself, famously. And, you know, Fred even has this video, which is now infamous, where he had this draft party, he had everyone around, and of course he goes undrafted. And he has to go up on stage and speak to all his friends and family after this sort of kind of a gut wrenching development. And he says, quote, "It wouldn't make sense with my story if I did get picked. I've been against the odds my whole life." What were your first impressions of Fred? And, you know, you were actually, you know, the one who actually broke the news that the Raptors had signed Fred and added him to Summer League and also training camp. But
yeah, I didn't break the news that they'd added him to Summer League. I think that was John Giovanni of Draft Express and now ESPN. But while I was at Summer League, I broke the news that the Raptors had signed him. And at that point, it was only $50,000 guaranteed. And what it looked like at the time was like DeLon Wright hadn't gotten hurt yet. DeLon Wright suffered that bad shoulder injury like right after that. But it looked like it was, you know, it looked like the standard, we're going to give you $50K to come try out for the team. And if you get cut, then we exhibit tenure, right? Like you get, you know, in this case, it wasn't that yet because that wasn't into the CBA yet. But it's effectively the same thing as we're going to exhibit tenure. You get that $50,000 bonus if you stay with the 905 long enough. It's the same thing they've done with, you know, Malcolm Miller in the past or Tyler Ennis this year or whatever, just to try to, you know, sweeten the pot. Because like you said, at that point, I think it was $26K is what a D-League salary for a Van Vliet would have been like at that point. So, you know, my first impressions of him, he honestly didn't blow me away in Summer League, but I think that that's part of what I think that fits Van Vliet's story because, like, not a lot of his game has been the type of thing that blows you away. And obviously he had a lot of success at Wichita State and you like the shooting and you like the leadership and playmaking, but it's not like this guy was like throwing down highlight reel dunks or jumping out of the gym. It's not like he's a guy who'd measure crazy well at the combine or anything like that. So I guess what stood out, you know, he was coming off the bench for the Summer League team too, because DeLon Wright was starting. Yep. So he didn't really have a chance to really show much flash. But, like, what stood out to me is, like, the first couple times I interviewed him, because at Summer League, no one else is around. You can talk to these guys as long as you want. It just, like, he seemed so, like, mentally ready and so sure of himself. And having been around a couple Summer Leagues now, you don't get that a lot. Like, guys will try to tell you the right thing and speak in cliche. But Van Vliet, like, the attitude Van Vliet has now, where it's like, yeah, of course I could be a starter in the NBA. Or last year, where it was, of course I can come back from a shooting slump. Or before that, like, of course I can win a G League championship. That was there kind of right away. And it wasn't like a cockiness. It was just a, I know who I am and I know what I can do kind of thing. So, you know, on the court, he didn't really start to grab my attention until he kind of got with the 905 later on. But the way, you know, his demeanor and the way he carries himself, and the way that kind of fits with where the Raptors were at that time, that was pretty obvious right out of the gate. You know, I remember too that, like, I think he was. So what I do every year is I always take everyone else's draft rankings because I don't get to watch as much NCAA basketball as I would need to, you know, evaluate these picks in real time or these signings. But I take all the other boards from people I trust that, like, you know, obviously the Draft Express and the Sam Vecinis and things like that, but also, like, the guys at the Stepien, some of the, you know, NBA Draft Twitter guys and stuff like that. And I think Van Vliet was fourth or fifth on the undrafted list based on, like, merging all those rankings together. So I at least had eyes on him and was excited the Raptors got him. But, yeah, in terms of first impressions, it took a little while for the on-court stuff. It took kind of until he got with the 905.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, credit Masai and Tolson, because apparently the first phone call they made after the draft was completed was to Fred. And you know, they wanted to get him. And you know, apparently, just looking into this story, like, it seems like everyone has, like, a Fred VanVleet story, you know what I mean, in the front office. Like, Bobby says, you know, him and his dad watched them at Wichita State, like, 2015 or something like that, and Masai and Dan Tolsman apparently watched them in the NCAA tournament, and it seems like everyone was really impressed by Fred at some point, and it's good that they brought him in. But again, I can't stress this enough, man, he really had to beat some odds, because...
Yeah.
Coming into that year, you know, it's customary for the Raptors to bring, 20 players into camp, and then you can, like, move a couple of contracts down, whatever. You want extra bodies for camp.
Yep.
He was fighting in 2016 in camp with Jared Uthoff, EJ Singler, Drew Crawford, Brady Heslip, and Yannick Morera for that final spot. And I think Fred probably had an inside edge because I think he was just better than these guys, but, like, still, like, that was they were all on the same level, relatively speaking, in terms of that uncertainty.
Yeah.
You got any Jared Uthoff, EJ Singler, Drew Crawford, Brady Heslip, Yannick Morera stories? What's going on?
And it makes me realize that I misspoke earlier in saying that the Exhibit 10 thing wasn't in place yet, because it must have been, because Singler and Yannick Morera and maybe a couple of those other guys got Exhibit 10s that year, but Fred was just on the 50K guarantee, and then it would have been his choice from there. So basically, the way I remember it is coming into camp, I think I handicapped Fred as the favorite because DeLon was hurt, not necessarily because Fred was better than these guys, but, you know, Heslip was not... That was the year Heslip kind of tried to become a point guard with the 905. He wasn't there yet, and to enter the season without a third point guard would have been... At that time, it would have seemed weird. The Raptors obviously got through all of 2019-2020 so far with only two point guards. But at the time, it looked like Van Vliet was the favorite for that reason. You know, Uthoff was semi-interesting because he was a big who could shoot. I always liked Drew Crawford as, like, if you were going to bring in, like, a Euro import to be, like, your 13th man, like a Lorenzo Brown type, he just had that kind of steadiness to him and was a good, like, off-court guy. But none of these guys... And, like... EJ Singler I liked a lot because he was one of the first 905ers, but he didn't have, like, he's not an NBA player. And then Morera was, like, a fringe G League starter. So it wasn't, you know, I think this really came down to, could Van Vliet run with the opportunity being the favorite because they need a third point guard? Or, like, would Uthoff, Singler, Heslip, or Crawford just shoot well enough and, like, play well enough in camp to take the spot? And so, you know, I think... I'm pretty sure I handicapped Van Vliet as the favorite. Like, I do that thing every year where I handicap the last couple roster spots. I'm pretty sure I had Van Vliet as the favorite. And it was going to take, like, him to stumble or, like, one of these other guys to just blow the doors off to beat him out.
Yeah. But, you know, so even though he wins the spot, though, he's, like, I mean, probably 15th man. Like, he's the fourth string point guard, man.
But don't forget, though, he had that the game they played. I want to say it was an Argentine team that came to the Air Canada Center.
Yeah. And San Lorenzo de Almagro.
And him and Norm, like, both went off for 30 in this preseason game. And then it was like there's a little juice to this guy too. That was probably the first game where it was like, okay, like, this guy could be more than, like, you know, the rotating cast of third point guards around the NBA. It was like, oh man, this guy's got some real juice to his game.
Yeah, I remember that game vividly. It was, no, I do not remember that game vividly. I remember that, I don't know, they played. But still, you know, in his rookie year, Fred VanVleet, obviously undrafted, you know, he has to basically scrap and fight to get to this point. And even still, he's the fourth-string point guard between Kyle Lowry, Corey Joseph, and DeLon right now. As you mentioned, DeLon had that separated shoulder, so DeLon wasn't ready to go until, I think, end of that calendar year, maybe December, maybe January, around that time. And so Fred, again, was kind of the third-string point guard, but it's a difficult situation, right? Really, I don't remember any games really that much from his rookie year, at least in the NBA, except for February 3rd. 2017. This is against Orlando. Do you remember this game? Because you and I actually watched this game together.
Yeah, I do. That was the one you watched at my place before you had soccer, right?
Yeah. 15 points against Orlando. It was a season high. They lost to Orlando, but you know,
of course they did. I remember. I don't have the dates in front of me, but I remember he had a couple like good games against Brooklyn where I think Kyle sat or Corey sat or something like
right,
that.
Right.
And it was like, you know, it wasn't 15 points, but it was like, okay, this guy, you know, playing full backup minutes looked pretty good. But yeah, I remember that Orlando game. You and your sit in my living room with your shin guards and cleats and getting me to cut orange slices up for you.
Yeah, I was fully dressed and ready to go because I think right after we did the pod, I like ran out of your apartment. And
yeah,
was went
Joe,
straight
was
to
Joe
Lamport.
Cash at my place too for that one?
Or was that a different
maybe.
One?
Okay.
Yeah, maybe actually. That was a real convenient spot, too.
Yeah, seriously.
But yeah, anyway, so the most, I think, notable thing for Fred in his rookie year, obviously, is that he goes down to the D-League and he wins the championship there. First off, like, so he plays in the D-League for 16 games. What was the motivation for him going to the D-League, and what did he work on when he was down there? What did he prove when he was down there?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing, first of all, is, like, you need minutes, right? And the Raptors are big on that, obviously. This year was kind of the exception because they've had so many injuries that they couldn't really afford to send guys down all the time. But the last couple of years, the whole point of the 905, first and foremost, was to get these guys playing. And you'll hear Nick, this was obviously a Dwayne Casey team, but you'll hear Nick Nurse talk about lots how he thinks the best way for guys to improve is to play. And even if that's not NBA minutes, the G League's a good place for that. So, you know, the first and foremost reason Fred was down there was to get reps in. And then, especially once DeLon was back, it was like, you know, what are the odds of this guy actually getting into an NBA game? He may as well be down there. And then I think there was an element, too, of because Van Vliet was such a steady hand right away. Like point guard play is so thin in the G League that, like, you get a lot of point guards who can fill it up. Like, you get a lot of Lorenzo Brown, Jordan Lloyd types, but you don't have a lot of, like, real point guards down there. So I think a guy like that, like Van Vliet, you get him down there and he can help, you know, a Pascal Siakam, a Jakob Poeltl, an Axel Tupan, who was a guy that they were still trying to develop at that point. So there was and Bruno was there too.
Oh, of course,
all about Bruno.
He was the star back then.
So I think there was some element of that. Van Vliet obviously had some things to work on his game. You know, one of his biggest weaknesses there, which I don't think will surprise anyone to hear, is like he wasn't a very good finisher when he went down there, and some of that was, you know, angles, and some of that was physicality. But he needed to work on that part of his game, and you know, some of the pick and roll stuff that he's only still now at the NBA level ironing out in terms of over dribbling or not seeing the pocket pass initially, things like that. But for the most part, he went down there and like, he hit the ground running pretty well. Like, it was, I don't want to say he was, like, too good for that level, because, like, his field goal percentage was only 41%. It's not like he was gangbusters or anything, but he went down, he hit 40% of his threes, and he was the smartest player on the floor from the minute he stepped foot. It was kind of, like, it was pretty clear that he was ready for more, and that, like, say the NBA didn't work out, well, I don't think there would have been much point in him hanging around the G League. Like, he was just, he was a four-year college senior. He was very, very polished for a G League point guard.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in the actual G League championship itself, so if I remember this correctly, they only sent Fred and Pascal down for the finals, the three-game series in the finals. Is that correct, or
no,
did they play the whole playoffs?
Pascal was there for, I think, all of it. Fred only went down once they got down 1-0 in the finals.
Okay.
Fred went down and they were like, go bring this home, man.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, because Kyle Lowry was also hurt for kind of, what, 2.5 months right before the playoffs, too?
Yeah, but that,
That was the wrist year, yeah.
Yeah.
He also won golfing. Randomly,
from late,
whatever.
From February 27th through to the end of the season, Van Vliet played every Raptors game except for like 7 or 8.
Yeah.
So he was playing pretty regularly. Yeah. So he only went down once they got down 1-0 to Rio Grande Valley.
That's correct. And they had to make a comeback. Yeah, Fred was actually low key. Like, obviously Pascal gets a lot of love for that G League Finals. Obviously Bruno had an incredible game 3. And recovered brilliantly because game 1, obviously, unsavory stories that came out of that. But yeah, you know, Fred was pretty damn good. I was looking at the numbers too. So Pascal obviously had the finals MVP, but Fred had 28-14 in game 3.
Yeah, and he had so game 2 was like, when he went down there, it was like a gritty, like, I think neither team scored 90 points even. And Fred didn't shoot that well, but, like, managed the game well and, like, flirted with a triple-double. And then Game 3, and the series at the time was best 2 out of 3, they were up, like, 20 in the third quarter. And Fred had 20-10 in the third quarter.
What?
Yeah, wow. He was just, okay. like, okay. Like, Bruno, that was the best game of Bruno's life to this day.
Yeah, yeah.
But, definitely. Like, Fred was the best player on the floor. And, yeah, it's, you know, Pascal got the MVP because he put up, like, 20-10 for the entire playoff run. But Fred was the big factor, in, especially in Game 3 as they like kind of pulled away.
Wow. So just like how Fred saved Kawhi in Game 6 of the Finals.
Yeah. It's funny, though. I remember, and like I don't know if you'd be happy with me saying this, but basically he's told me since that, like we talked about, like the Raptors were playing the Bucks in the first round of the playoffs while that was going on. Like that night of
right,
Game 3
yeah.
was Game 6 of the Raptors where they almost blew the Game 6 in Milwaukee.
That's right. That's right.
The closeout game. And he told me, he was basically like, yeah, they told me to, like, they got one down 1-0, and they told me to go win the championship. It's like, because they were like, you know, Brady Heslop was an awesome G Leaguer and an awesome Canada basketball player, but he's not, like, he's not a point guard, and that's what had to do when Van Vliet wasn't down there.
I mean, it worked out, man. They still closed out against Milwaukee, and then whatever. It's not like it would have affected the 2017 sweep by LeBron. So yeah, I think, you know, in overall, I think in his rookie year, this, you know, just considering the circumstance that he came into, I think Fred actually did reasonably well in his rookie year. Again, he didn't play that much, but he beat a lot of odds to even get to that position, and then to cap it off with the D-League title, it's pretty great. The next year, though, the bench mob year, so this is the year where Nick Nurse sort of takes over, you know, in terms of just like redrawing the offense. Obviously, Dwayne is still coach, and he wins Coach of the Year. But Nick Nurse does a lot of sort of revamping of the offense. And I feel like this is where it kind of really helped Fred in a way, just because it was a year where there was just a lot more. It went from being a very top heavy team of like Kyle and DeMar have the ball in their hands all the time and they run pick and roll or they isolate, but that's generally how they're going to attack, to a team that looks a lot more like now, where there's a lot more triple handouts, a lot more spacing on the floor. There's stories about how Nick Nurse apparently. They basically reinvented basketball and said corner shots were worth like 4 points and mid-range shots were worth like -1 or something like that. Like, they really drilled it into to get this modern style of play going. And I think it really helped Fred because I think it really shifted the team into something that was able to leverage his skill set. Because, you know, not only did shooting become a premium, and of course Fred was a very good shooter even back then, but, you know, it really created a lot of situations where they needed two point guards on the floor a lot. And I think this is really where Fred really emerged. It was the second year, because at the start of the year, we weren't even sure what his role was going to be. But at the end of the year, he was third in Sixth Man of the Year voting. What do you remember about Fred in that bench mob year?
Yeah, it's, you know, I think your point about how the offense changed and them running two point guards together a lot of the time is an important one. Because especially at that point in his development, like, he kind of needed that second point guard out there. And I remember talking a lot at those times about, it's great to have two point guards, but, like, it probably makes more sense once things grind down to the half court to actually have the ball in DeLon's hands, because Fred's such a good floor spacer, 41.4% on threes that year. And him and DeLon just, like, always played so well off of each other at both ends of the floor. You know, obviously Fred did a lot and came a long way that season. I think the big kind of turning point for me with Fred that year was, like, because that was the first time he had a sample against actual NBA players. Like, you know, it's one thing to be a ball hound in the G League when you're playing against G League point guards. It's another when you play 1,500 minutes in the NBA, and not only are you surviving at 5'11" on defense, you're, like, really, really good defensively. And those benchmob units were, you know, it's not like CJ Miles was an awesome defender at that point, and none of those guys was like, you know, Pascal was still a little kind of frenetic on defense, and Poeltl could protect the rim, but he wasn't quite what he is yet. But those
foul prone,
foul prone, and those groups though were, you know, really solid. We remember joking all the time about like how they go on these 5 minute long like 4-0 runs, but Fred was a huge part of that defensively. So I think that's kind of when it started to click that the defense could carry over as well. Obviously, offensively, he still had some of the limitations in terms of his finishing and his ability to create one-on-one against better defenders and stuff. But, you know, him as a co-point guard and then showing that even at his size, he'd be able to survive as a co-point guard was really important, especially heading into, you know, a free agent year with DeLon and DeLon's status kind of up in the air, too.
Yeah, for sure. You know, defensively, the one memory I had from that season for Fred was there was that game in March where it was in Scotiabank and the Houston Rockets were in town. I think they had won 17 straight or something dumb like that. Like, they were really clicking that. Chris Paul, James Harden, Rockets team with Clint Capella. There was something like, it was like when the three of those guys played together, they were just like unbeatable, apparently. And there was that at the start of the fourth quarter. It was a close game. Raptors were playing really well, and Fred was on there because, you know, that's when the bench was really shining. It was the start of the fourth quarter, and Fred just like pressured the hell out of Chris Paul and forced him into like two turnovers. And it reminded me of this quote that Fred said at the time. I think he told someone on my sports. It was either you or Alex. But he said, quote, people were probably like, who the fuck is this kid coming into the game, picking us up full court? I don't even look like an NBA player to most guys, which I thought that was a really good, you know, just especially with Chris Paul, like he's such a steady ball handler. He has one of the nicest handles pretty much in NBA history. And so for Fred to be able to hound him was kind of like a nice, you know, just foretelling the fact that, one day he was going to guard Steph Curry in the finals and win.
Yeah. I think there's a nice, like, not symmetry is not the word, but, like, Chris Paul is a guy who, obviously, he was a very high draft pick and he's going to be a Hall of Famer and stuff, but, like, he's been a little underappreciated, and I think it's because so much of his game lies in, like, the cerebral aspect. So for, like, Van Vliet to come up with a huge strip against a guy like that, especially, was, like, a good kind of signifier, I guess. It's probably one of these things that we're ascribing more meaning to after the fact, but like, you know, if you can strip the brain genius Chris Paul in a big moment like that in a tight game against a red hot team, that probably says some good things about your defensive potential.
Yeah, for sure. And that's the other thing that stood out for me for Fred that season was just like he started developing this reputation for being really clutch. You know, like over the course of the year, Dwayne Casey, who generally speaking you know, was more of a traditional coach, definitely preferred and leaned heavily on veterans. But, you know, even for Dwayne Casey, like, he started to really trust Fred as one of the fourth quarter guys. And, you know, every single fourth quarter, it was a question of whether they were going to go with OG, who was a rookie that year, or they were going to go with Fred and go a little bit smaller in the backcourt. But, you know, that and you know, the best example of this, obviously, was that Pistons game where DeMar had the best dunk. I think, outside of Vince, probably, like, the best dunk in a Raptor uniform, you know, on Anthony Tolliver. But then,
and that might even, like, top the in-game Vince. Obviously, Vince's dunk contest and his USA basketball ones, but I'm trying to think of one that was that devastating in-game.
I was going to say, you don't really see a lot of dunks to force OT, like, clutch dunks, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's basically just DeMar.
Poor Anthony Tolliver, man.
Bro,
it's like and Anthony Tolliver every year now getting like attached to the Raptors in buyout rumors. It's like, man, you can't come back. You can't do that.
Yeah, no, he's just gonna have constant PTSD playing on the Raptors. Yeah, I mean, man, I honestly wanted him too, just because I felt like Anthony Tolliver was always like, you know, a really diet version of Patrick Patterson. You know, kind of that, like, power forward, can space the floor a little bit, you know, made some heads-up play, unselfish. But realistically, what are we doing? We don't
need that. Has an open tab at EFS, yeah.
Okay. but, yeah, Fred, in overtime in that game, because DeMar dunked it. It forced OT, but in overtime, DeMar had the exact same play, drives all the way down the length of the floor, was pretty much going to dunk it again, but this time he kicks it out to Fred, who was in the corner. And Fred hits the shot. The crazy thing is Fred was, I think, 0 of 10 in that game, and still, despite the fact that he was 0 of 10, he played a lot of the fourth quarter. He plays overtime, and then he hits the game-winning shot. And this is actually something DeMar and Fred talked about in their IG story, or in their IG Live very recently, was that they told the story. They were like, DeMar was telling him apparently throughout the game, like, yo, you know, just keep shooting that thing. Like, I trust you, you know what I mean? And for a second-year guy to get that kind of trust was kind of unbelievable. And that's why it was super devastating that on game 82 of the season in Miami, Fred VanVleet gets hurt.
Oh, my God.
He runs into Bam Adebayo on a screen, just guarding some just random play. It wasn't dirty, but whatever. It's Miami Heat basketball. And Fred separates, I think, what, he separated his shoulder or something like that? And he didn't really play at all in the Washington series until game six. And he was actually great in that one.
Yeah, but, so what he tried to do was, that was, I mean, it's far enough away now that it's not a big deal. And I reported some of this at the time, but his timeline after that shoulder injury was much longer than anyone let on. And he tried to come back in game two, and he played 3 minutes against the Wizards, and he just, like, obviously didn't have it, and then he didn't come back until game six. Like, even in that Cavs series, was just, like, not all the way. He was fine. He shot the ball okay, but he, like, clearly wasn't the same guy. And they obviously, at that point, like, his minutes had increased every month of the season pretty much. And at that point, they needed, like, 25 minutes a game of sixth man of the year Fred VanVleet. And that shoulder kind of sapped him of that. And I remember, like he had to miss, like, a, not miss because it was the offseason, but, like, he had to shut it down for, like, a pretty long time after that, too. Like, so as much as, you know, he didn't play super well throughout the playoffs, like, the fact that he gutted that out and was playing at all was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, exactly. And especially in Game 6, because that was Game 6 against Washington, whatever. It was a freaking 1-8 matchup. But still, it went six games because, you know, this is the Raptors. And, you know, Fred was, like, coming off of injury, but he still closed that fourth quarter ahead of DeMar. Like, DeMar ends up playing that fourth quarter, but they really make this push at the start of the fourth quarter. And I just remember Fred making a lot of Kyle Lowry, like, kind of plays. Like, I remember reading back on what I wrote about this game. I was like, a lot of, like, plus minus. And I'm like, yeah, this is Lowry-esque in a way.
Yeah, because it would have been him and Kyle on Wall and Beal for most of that stretch, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and exactly. And you need that defensive ability because, yeah, that was a, I mean, shout out Wall and Beal, man. They were really tough in that series, especially Beal.
And Mike Scott. Shout out Mike Scott.
Oh, God. No, don't even say the name, man, please. Yeah, no, I really, he's all-time Gerald Henderson Award winner. And then, so after that year, this is 2018, Fred hits free agency. The Raptors, you know, obviously they end up re-signing him on a two-year deal, and he's now on the last year of that two-year deal. But, you know, there was some uncertainty, because I think if you were a team that was smart in the NBA, you would have targeted Fred VanVleet. He was relatively affordable. The Raptors were kind of limited in terms of how much money they can give him. And, you know, I remember at the time, Phoenix and maybe Utah were kind of candidates to try to get Fred, but Fred ultimately re-signs. What do you remember about just sort of like that negotiation process and, you know, his decision to come back to Toronto and Toronto's decision to keep him?
Yeah, so, I mean, that was going to be an interesting one because he was only a two-year RFA, you know, he was subject to the arenas provision, so if a team wanted to go long-term on him, they couldn't, so no one could offer more than the mid-level for the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. But a team could have conceivably backloaded a deal, and then maybe the Raptors hesitate if suddenly you're talking like 444 instead of 218 or something like that. Maybe the Raptors are a little hesitant because you got Lowry.
The Tyler Johnson contract.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So what I remember is the Utah thing was weird just because like Utah's ability to get into cap space to do that would have been like, I think it might have, I'd have to go back and look at their cap sheet, but, like, I think it would have maybe required the Raptors to play ball on a sign-and-trade or something. Phoenix was the interesting one because, like, if you look at what they had then and where they've gone since, Fred VanVleet on a, like, a four-year deal would have been really smart. But, of course, they're the Suns, so they spent $15 million on Trevor Ariza on a one-year deal instead so that they could trade him halfway through the season.
Got Kelly Oubre. That's not bad.
That's true. But they, yeah, one wave got to another, eh?
Yeah. Wow.
okay. Yeah, so the Phoenix was the one that, like, me as someone who wanted the Raptors to keep VanVleet, that was the team I kind of had eyes on. And then once they signed Ariza, you know, I remember hearing that, like, they had basically told Van Vliet, like, hey, we're still interested, but, like, we got to move some things around. And at that point, the Raptors came correct pretty much, like, moment number one with a two-year deal at the full amount that they could offer him. Mm-hmm. So, like, at that point, that, you know, if you're Van Vliet, that gets you into unrestricted free agency at age 26, which is pretty good. Obviously, he couldn't foresee this mess coming. I mean, but, you know, on paper, it looked like that had been a pretty smart move, because we were talking before the hiatus of, like, you know, hey, has Fred priced himself into, like, the $20 million-plus range when you look at teams like Detroit and Chicago that need a youngish point guard and have lots of cap space and stuff. So it seemed like, you know, looking back at the time, too, but right now it looks like one of those deals that benefited both sides. Fred got as much money as he could over a two-year deal and got to re-enter the market, and the Raptors got to, you know, not that you couldn't see that Van Vliet was going to be a really good player after 2017-2018, but you basically bought two more years to evaluate whether you wanted to pay him as the guy to hand the reins over when Lowry's done.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a pretty good deal.
It was a perfect deal for both sides. And so last year, the championship season, just in the regular season, I felt like I wasn't that impressed by Fred. I don't know what it was. Maybe he was struggling at times with injuries or whatever. It was also that sort of battle with DeLon, right? Now, DeLon had a chance to sign an extension. He chose not to. And I think that probably kind of sealed his fate a little bit. But yeah, it was kind of a battle at times. I preferred Fred to DeLon just because I felt like Fred had this ability to sort of really show up when games got really tough. And I appreciated that quality about it that I felt like DeLon didn't have sometimes. But I don't know. I wasn't that impressed with Fred. And I remember, I mean, this, look, I'm just telling on myself at this point, but whatever. It's already been out there. But I remember when Jeremy Lin was acquired by the Raptors at the trade deadline, I was like, yes, there we go. Finally, we have a backup point guard. I'm like, yo, Fred is better than Jeremy, but, like, honestly, I don't know, man. Fred was struggling so much that I was like, you know what, Jeremy might actually be able to sort of step in and maybe steal some backup minutes. Of course, that never happened. That never happened. And as soon as that trade deadline game happened, you know, the Raptors had, like, seven players. Kawhi was resting for some odd reason, even though they only had seven players. And Fred, you know, I think he had a season high that game, 30 points against Atlanta in a win. But yeah, I don't know, man. What was going on in the regular season? Because it wasn't that impressive. It wasn't the Fred we see today, and it wasn't the Fred that we saw, you know, in the second half of the playoffs last year.
Yeah, I mean, statistically, obviously the counting stats are a little better than his bench mob year just because he played more. But statistically, like, that was the worst of his three main seasons. His PR was down. His true shooting percentage was down. He got to the rim less. He finished he's never finished well at the rim, but he finished particularly poorly at the rim, and he was getting there less. So, you know, I think it's tough because I think, you know, for a lot of those guys that had the bench mob success, you've got to adjust a little bit, and you're trying to figure out how to expand your role. And, like, Fred was also going starter to bench. And like you said, he dealt with a bunch of injuries himself. He missed 18 games, and there were probably, you know, another dozen where it wasn't clear if he was going to play until closer to game time and stuff. So, you know, that's where some of the questions started to come in of, okay, could he actually be a full-time starter? Like, can he hold up to that? And that's probably not fair in that year only, because, like, obviously the shoulder thing was kind of a freak thing against Bam the year prior, and he had played 76 regular season games, but he dealt with some persistent back stuff and some ankle stuff and things like that. But no, I think, you know, the thing that we forget sometimes is, like, young players don't develop in linear fashion all the time. Sometimes and Siakam's a good example of that too, and we'll talk about, because even though season to season he's kind of linearly progressed, within those seasons he's taken steps back and stuff. So I think for Van Vliet, you know, you're going from playing a lot of your minutes with DeLon to playing a lot of your minutes alongside Kyle or Kawhi. You know, you're sometimes leading the bench unit, and sometimes you're kind of trying to slide into a fourth man role in the offense. And then, you know, just the fact that his three-point percentage was down a couple ticks, you know, that means a lot for a guy who takes almost half of his shots from three-point range. Even though he was still really good, you know, if half your shots are threes and your three-point percentage drops a couple percentage points, that's going to be noticeable. But I think that's really it, man. He was adjusting to different roles, and sometimes guys don't, you know, improve step by step each year.
Yeah, and last year was really strange, especially in the regular season, because like the bench just like didn't play well. Everyone off the bench kind of struggled. I don't know. Like JV played well off the bench. That's about it.
And I think that that's kind of the tough counter sometimes to, you know, obviously Nick Nurse's strategy of changing the starting lineup a lot and being super flexible with groups, that has real playoff implications and real playoff benefits because you are familiar a lot of different ways and you're comfortable starting a bunch of different ways. And especially once you tighten the rotation down to like eight guys and you've played every iteration of those eight guys together, it's super valuable. But I think that when you look at, you know, what made the bench mob successful and what makes full bench units successful in general, a lot of it is that role consistency and role stability. Mm-hmm. So the flip side of changing your starters around all the time and having injuries and having guys in and out and making a midseason trade is that those guys don't really, you know, those young guys playing in more narrowly defined roles don't really get to stay in those and get that same comfort level. So I think that was an adjustment for a lot of guys. Like OG didn't do super well off of the bench. It wasn't a great Norman Powell year. Nope. A lot of guys struggled with that.
Yeah, for sure. Now, post-trade deadline, you know, I think Fred kind of plays a little bit better. He averages 13-6, you know, shoots 42% from three over that stretch. He looks a little bit better. Now, heading into the playoffs, though, it was tough. Like, he was okay in game one against Orlando. He scored more than 0 points. So, definitely was not the worst point guard that day. But there was 14 straight games for Fred VanVleet where he scored under 10 points from game two of the Orlando series through game three of the Milwaukee series. He was struggling really bad.
He shot 14% on threes over that stretch. Over 14 games.
I don't understand it. Like, I actually don't understand it. For someone who's as inconsistent, whatever. You know, playoffs are tough, length, bad matchup. You know, James Ennis is out there blocking him, whatever. I get it. But, like, how did his performance dip that much? Because it didn't make any sense that he was struggling that badly.
Yeah, and I don't know, because, like, sometimes, you know, we remember the Kyle Lowry shooting slumps where he was, like, famously getting shots up super late at night, and it was, like, it was clear that there was, like, a psychological component to that. But VanVleet, through all of this, was basically just like, yeah, I'm not worried about it. I'll start hitting them eventually.
Yep.
And, like, I don't know if, like, have you ever watched VanVleet shoot up close when he's warming up or whatever, and, like, he kind of spins the ball sideways off his thumb?
Yep. Yep.
I wonder if, like, because he has, it's kind of like if a pitcher has a quirky delivery, it's easier to lose the feel on it. I wonder if maybe just because he lets his shot off weird, he can, like, lose the touch on it. But he's not, like, other than that stretch, he's never been, like, an especially inconsistent three-point shooter. Everyone's an inconsistent three-point shooter unless you're, like, Steph Curry. But really, like, there's not a good explanation for why for, you know, over a month, this guy just shot threes like, I don't know, like sophomore Pascal Siakam, basically.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't have a good explanation for it, man. There's not a...
See, the thing. Like, I never went so far as to say, look, maybe go with Jeremy Lin ahead of Fred. But, you know, there were times where I was like, yo, Fred is really not cutting it. Norm's not really getting any run. You might as well put Norm in, maybe try Norm at point guard. Like, I was that desperate. And, you know, obviously Fred had, you know, this story is, again, very well chronicled. But, you know, he has this huge turning point. His second child, his first son, Fred Jr., was born. And after that point, he was really good. Like, he went from, again, 14 straight games of under 10 points to after Fred Jr. was born against, you know, three games against Milwaukee and six games against Golden State. He averages 14.7 points. He shoots 51% from the field. It's an incredible turnaround. But mostly I just want to tell this because, like, I remember sitting in those press conferences where Fred was talking about sort of after game five, they were asking him, like, yo, what's your life been like? Because, you know, you just had a second child in the middle of this playoffs and you're in different cities. Like, what's going on? And Fred basically told the story where on a Monday, he was in Toronto. He gets the phone call from his girlfriend, you know, the water broke, all right? You got to come down. So he flies down to Rockford that afternoon. The baby comes out that night, 9:30. He's unable to get discharged that day. He takes a nap at the hospital. Can't be that accommodating. He flies back to Toronto around 2 p.m. that game day. That was Tuesday. He gets a nap in before the game, and then he goes out, scores 13-6 in game four for the win. Then that night, they fly to Milwaukee for game five. When he got down to Milwaukee, he finally got to sleep. Right, he sits in a car, he drives to Rockford from Milwaukee, which is about an hour 45 drive, still kind of a long drive. spends the night with his baby. Finally, they get discharged from the hospital. They got to do all these tests and stuff like that. And then he drives back to Milwaukee for game five, like basically the next day, and takes another nap, and then he hits seven threes.
Seven threes.
It doesn't make any sense, man. Like I don't understand.
Matt Moore still hasn't logged off over this.
Yeah, I just put out a clip where Fred VanVleet, remember game six, Kyle Lowry crashed the Fred VanVleet press conference and asked Fred how he feels to be a champion. I feel like HP's not retweeting that one.
Oh, man. Yeah. That was crazy, though. I guess before we talk about that specifically, though, what is the better Raptors no sleep story? Fred VanVleet game, what was it, game four, or PJ Tucker the deadline?
Oh man, what was that? 25 straight hours for PJ Tucker? PJ Tucker was talking with he was just very hopped up. I don't know, man. He was just really hopped up. I've never seen a guy that intense. I didn't remember that much of rookie PJ, so. So I didn't remember I didn't know how he was going to be personality-wise. And then when he came in, and like he bullies Isaiah Thomas, he like really locks him down, which was a big deal at the time because Isaiah was having, Celtics fans swore he was having an MVP season. And then afterwards, he just says, like, yo, we're going to be a great defensive team. Once DeMar starts playing some defense, we're going to be a great defensive team. And I was like, yo, I love this guy. He's like, yeah, me and Serge don't know any of the plays. It's fine. It's like, well... It was 2017. That was the last pound the rock era. So, you know, just set a screen and wait in the corner for a three. That's about it.
Yeah. I don't know what else. Good use of PJ Tucker, man.
Yeah. Fred, I mean, yeah. So, you know, he has incredible moments, obviously, throughout the playoffs, especially the seven threes against the Bucks. Like, and they needed every one of those threes. Like, every single one of those threes. And of course, you know, he's pretty good in game six as well to close it out in Toronto. And then really his time to shine was really in the finals where, he takes over for Danny Green, as the second half starter. Now they've actually talked about this, Danny and Fred inside the green room after they won the championship and stuff. They talked about it and Fred was basically like, yo, you know, I'm just pretending that my back hurts or whatever, so you know I gotta stay warm. you can't put me on the bench. That was his excuse.
Yeah. He said it in training camp too. He said he finessed the starting spot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So good job. But honestly though, he was really good. And really the reason Nick made that move is because they just needed someone to guard Steph Curry in the third quarter. The Warriors were so damn good last season in the third quarter. Steph was a big part of that. And you just needed your best on-ball defender against Steph in that moment. That's really what it boiled down to.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And, like, you know, you can debate who the Raptors' best defender overall is or whatever, but when it comes to chasing guys off of screens and getting around them and kind of denying ball on the perimeter, like, Fred's their best guy. And we saw little glimpses of that in that Washington Game 6 that we talked about, and you saw little bits of it, you know, earlier in the postseason with Redick and things like that too. He's very good at that.
Yeah.
And that's, Steph obviously still got his shots off because he's Steph Curry, but even the luxury of like, we're only going to put one guy on Steph Curry is just a huge thing when, you know, he's surrounded by the guys he's surrounded by. Like, you know, I think people have overstated a little bit the injury situation of Golden State, but they were certainly low on guys who could help Steph Curry space the floor, at least when Klay Thompson sat. Like those Steph on Klay off minutes were a grind for the Warriors, and a lot of that's because of Fred.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of that's also because, you know, Quinn Cook was like the Warriors' third best player, but
bro, it was tough, man. DeMarcus Cousins would go entire games like with a lot of 2 points. Alphonso McKinney, I mean, you know, Raptors 905 legend, of course, but
yeah.
I mean, bro, he was maybe the Raptors' third best player in the finals. I don't even know. Every time he guarded Kawhi, Kawhi got a foul, man.
Yeah, it's not his fault that he got put one-on-one against Kawhi Leonard. It'd be like, you know, it'd be like picking out any of the Raptors that had to guard LeBron one-on-one for 3 years and being like, well, that guy's the worst Raptor. It's like, no, he had to guard LeBron. That's, what are you going to do?
And of course, there's that famous clip of Steph Curry begging Sean Livingston for the switch to guard Fred, which is so funny because Sean Livingston retired after that game. So Fred gets the Finals MVP. Shout out to him. And then this season, you know,
say Fred gets the Finals MVP? He didn't get the Finals MVP.
He got a Finals MVP vote. All right.
Yeah, he got one. Let's not. But
I feel like you should get like some sort of certificate or something in your house, like a small plaque. Maybe not like a whole trophy, but like, you know, like a Like a, you could put that on your LinkedIn, for example, for sure. Like,
oh yeah, like he's got the endorsement from Hubie Brown.
Yeah, Hubie Brown's like, yo, great on ball defender, clutch shooter, and of course, you know, in Game Six, like in the fourth quarter, he scores 12 points, man. Like, yeah, Fred really brought that shit home.
It's huge, man. Kyle opened it up, and then Fred kind of got it done.
Yep. And then so this year he comes in, he earns a starting spot. It was a little strange to me that Nick Nurse declared right away, like, Fred's going to be my starter the whole year. And of course, Fred has missed some games, and that has allowed Norm to start. And Norm has obviously been really great in the starting role as well, in a different way, but still really great. But if you just look at it all in the whole, like, Fred's had a like pretty damn good year. Like, has he proven to you this year that he's a starting caliber point guard? I mean, this might sound dumb because he's literally started 48 games, but he's averaging 17.6 points, 6.6 assists, 1.9 steals, shooting 39% from three on 7 attempts per game. For a great team, and he's great defensively. Is he a starter? Has he proven that to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's proven that he's a starter. I don't know if he's proven he's like a high-end starter. I would still have some concerns about his scoring efficiency and less so than in years past, but his pick-and-roll operating is still like a work in progress, which it should be. He's a fourth-year player. He's only 26. Point guards sometimes come along a little slowly because there's such a mental toll on that position. You look and, like, he was below average for true shooting percentage, and he's only at, like, a 22% usage rate. Still not a guy who can finish at the rim really well. He was shooting under 55% at the rim. And then shooting less than 20% in that floater range, the, like, 3 to 10-foot range. So, you know, for him to really reach that top level of starter, I'd want to see the finishing package continue to improve and some of the pick-and-roll passing. Yeah, I don't think there's any question that, especially if you're talking about the type of team that could try to poach this guy from Toronto in free agency, I don't think there's any question. He's played 36 minutes a game on, you know, a top three or four team in the league, and he's put up good numbers. And like you said, he's, you know, he probably had a good case to make second team all defense, depending on what your appetite is for, like, missed games and things like that. I guess, yeah, along with the finishing, the durability is a question just in terms of how much you want to pay. I don't think there's any question that this guy can start and play a full-time role at a really good level in the NBA. It's just, you know, when you're drawing those tiers of, like, is he a top 10 point guard? Is he a top 20 point guard? You know, that's where we still don't, you know, you still need to see the scoring efficiency come up just a little bit.
Yeah. And of course, they've had different careers, and, you know, Kyle obviously has made many jumps in his career, but just if you compare that at their same ages, or even at the same experience, like, Fred is ahead of where Kyle was. And of course, Kyle made multiple leaps to get to a level where he's where he is. But yeah, I mean, it's really impressive. It's really impressive. And, you know, I was going to ask about free agency, but realistically, with COVID going on, like, there's so many questions with, in terms of just, like, basic finances that it's hard to predict any of these things. But
I do just want to say, sorry, you mentioned, like, the Lowry comp. And I think, obviously, we get into sometimes, you know, we stretch a little bit to fit these things because we would love for a guy like Van Vliet to follow along the same path as Lowry. But the thing within their profiles that is really encouraging to me is that it was Lowry's fifth season in the league when he started to finish at the rim well. And, you know, some of that was he became less of a drive-oriented point guard. Like, he just didn't go to the rim as much, and he traded a lot of rim shots away for a higher volume of threes. But he also jumped from being a guy who hung in the low 50s as a finisher his first four seasons to a guy who could hang in the high 50s, low 60s, sometimes even higher. So, you know, some of that is probably the condition he worked himself into and picking up the smarts in terms of, like, angles and body in, ball out, all that stuff. Yeah. But I do think that it's at least a good data point to say that, like, you're not stuck as a poor finisher 4 years into your career.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I was going to ask about free agency, but really, you know, there's too much uncertainty. So I will just agree that, Fred was going to be one of the top free agents on the market. And he still will be. It's just we don't know the exact numbers without honestly seeing how long this is.
We don't know how much the cap's going to drop. We don't know if they're going to smooth it over a couple years or whatever. So there's not a ton of point.
And then just to wrap up on Fred, before we go talk on Pascal, just a couple of nice quotes that I thought I found. You know, this is from Kyle Lowry. Look what he did in college. And by the way, the Wichita State Shockers went 91-15 with Fred as a starter in 3 years. That takes skill, that takes knowledge, that takes smarts. And then he's got here, and you could tell that he's a guy who watches basketball, knows basketball, and knows his job. He's smart as shit. He sees things from the same perspective as I do. And that's from Lowry, who, you know, we know that he's one of the most brilliant players in the NBA. And that's also something where if you read enough about Fred, at every single level, his coaches will talk about how Fred was always a guy who coaches went to ask for his opinion on what he saw in the game, because he sees the game at that level. And even Kyle and DeMar, you know, especially in that second year, but even at times in that first year, you know, consulted Fred, which is just rare, you know? He's just always had a great game sense.
It's like, and I think, you know, I talked about kind of his demeanor as far back as Summer League and stuff, and I think, you know, it's obviously, it's more on the vets to bring the young guys along than the young guys to kind of force their way. But when you come in with an attitude like that and that level of intelligence, and you kind of approach the, like, asking the vets the right way, I think, you know, having them in your corner and advocating you can really help your development. And the Raptors have done a good job of, you know, identifying guys that kind of fit that and can kind of carry that on. And it's been awesome to see over the years, like Van Vliet and Norm too, really kind of take on a lot of that Kyle DeMar leadership that they pass on and try to pass it on to the next round of guys.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's really perfect. DeMar, speaking of DeMar, he said, quote, "Freddie is one of those teammates that will go down in my book as one of my favorites by his toughness and the way he carries himself as an individual. It speaks volumes and it shows in big moments. He's a tough little firecracker." Larry also said, you know, about Fred, "He will be an all-star. Simple as that. I'm serious. He's going to be an all-star at some point," which, I don't disagree. He's really had a great trajectory, and if he continues, if he makes one more leap, he's there. He was honestly on borderline this year, but it's close. And
yeah, I mean, this year would have required people to be like, "Oh, we appreciate defense."
That's a big ask.
Yeah,
But still, it's close enough, right? Like, his numbers aren't that far off, and you know, we'll see. I mean, he's got to improve a couple of things, but it's definitely not out of the realm of possibility. Fred.
And, like, point guards develop slowly sometimes. And I'm not even saying that as, like, Van Vliet has developed slowly. He obviously hasn't. He's a huge contributor on a championship team and a very good regular season team this year. But, like, we also have to allow a little bit for, like, you know, he could figure some extra things out in a year 5 or year 6.
Yeah. I mean, listen, everyone hits a growth spurt at 26. Just,
I'm not saying he's going to get bigger, but he wider, might, like,
taller, but whatever.
Yeah, maybe he learns how to throw his ass around in the paint.
Hey, man, listen. That's the difference right there between Kyle and Fred. Fred also, by the way, I feel like he's really, you know, embodied a lot of what the Raptors represent. And he said this himself. He said, quote, "It's not the glam stars. We got guys who had to get it the long way, who had to get it out of the mud, who had to get it against the grain. And we were a team full of them, coming from all different places, all walks of life, all different life stories to get to this point. But we got some talent. We got some talent for sure." And I think that's just, you know, he embodies the spirit of the team really well. And the last little quote that I got from Fred was from Steve Forbes, who's a coach at Wichita. And apparently he's friends with Nick Nurse. But he said, quote, "We're in the middle of a game, and we're having a hard time guarding him." And this is DeLon Wright that we're talking about. This was in college. "And Fred came to me during a time I said, I want him. And he basically just shut his water off. I relayed that message to Nick Nurse. Nick and I are really good friends. And I relayed that story to them when they brought Fred to the Raptors. I told Nick, quote, if you give guys like him a chance, he'll beat them out. To go undrafted and then to go beat out a first round pick. That's pretty hard to do. But I'm not surprised." Like,
yeah, that's pretty much it, man.
That's Fred. Okay, so we talked a lot about Fred. His story is incredible. That rookie class, obviously Fred didn't come in and get drafted, but that same rookie class for the Raptors, just an incredible haul, because the Raptors got Fred, they got Pascal, and they got Jakob Poeltl. Poeltl's obviously, you know, was part of that Kawhi trade. But Pascal, let's move over to him. So 2016, I'm just going to ask you off the top, were you happy with the pick? Because 27th selection, the Raptors had a couple of options on the board. There's a lot of hype for guys like Scal Labissiere. Deontay Davis was, I think, invited to the green room and slid to the second round. Were you happy the Raptors took Pascal? What was your reaction?
So I went back and checked out my draft night stuff from this, and Scal and Deontay Davis were the two guys that I was like, oh, these guys were still there. What's up? But it was like the text of what I wrote was pretty much like, already at that point I was like, we can't really doubt the Raptors, like, if they see something here. And that was probably, that year was probably the most I ever prepared for the draft, because they had two first round picks and I was living a short walk to OVO. Whoa. So I was at like every one of the pre-draft workouts except the one with Pascal and Jakob, because that one was held in Buffalo.
Right, the secret one. Yeah.
Yeah. But so like I had dug pretty deep, but that was, it was a good learning experience to go through that draft year and see where guys have gone since, because I think it really hammered home for me the value of like the interview process and the like non on court stuff.
Right.
Also, like, you know, maybe we shouldn't discount a guy putting up 20 and 10 getting double teams just because he's on a smaller school. Yep. So, you know, I wasn't like thrilled with the pick. I really liked Deontay Davis. Without getting into specifics, there is value in being able to talk to a player and interview them, it turns out, in terms of projecting them forward. So,
yeah.
Yeah, not surprised in retrospect that they didn't go the Deontay Davis route, but that was kind of, it's funny, I also, Patrick McCaw was the guy that I wanted with that
pick.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, I really
So you were McCaw. Original Patrick McCaw stan.
Yeah, I really liked McCaw coming out of the draft. But no, I was fine with it from a, like, okay, I trust the Raptors. At that point, too, like, because they had a year of the G League under their belt, I was like, okay, well, like, maybe this is, like, maybe we're going to see what this looks like, right? Like, you mm-hmm. draft a longer-term guy and throw him in the G League. Let's see what that looks like. So I was, like, pretty excited. But no, I wasn't, like, this is my guy. I think I had him ranked in the 40s or something like that.
Right.
But by the time Summer League rolled around and I had, like, caught up on video and, like, got to talk to him once or twice, I wrote, like, that big feature on him for Sportsnet that year at Summer League, even though he only played 15 minutes. You know, I think you started to see pretty quickly, you know, even more quickly than with Fred, you started to see that there was something here more than maybe just the energy guy.
Yeah. But, you know, I did look into that Sportsnet article, and one of your concluding thoughts was that, quote, nobody's asking Siakam to fill such big shoes right away, but there's a sense that he could help replace some of the spirit loss with the departure of Bismack Biyombo, if not some of the minutes as well. So it wasn't that high of a bar, right? And I'm not signaling you out at all, because I think I called him like an Al-Farouq Aminu type. And I think Forbes had Pascal that pick rated as a D-. So
Dwayne Casey said Bo Outlaw was his player comp.
Yep.
And like, Bo Outlaw was like a really good defender, but like also never averaged double-digit points in his career.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. Listen, if the Raptors knew what Pascal Siakam was going to turn into, they would have never picked him 27th. They would have picked him 9th.
It's the old Tom Brady or Draymond Green thing. If you really thought he was going to be that good, you wouldn't have waited until the 7th round for Brady. Or, like, I think Draymond was the Warriors' 3rd pick in that draft.
Yeah, that's right. It was Harrison Barnes and Festus Ezeli.
Ooh.
Yeah. I mean, Festus was good Barnes. For... Well, yeah, Harrison Barnes, yeah. Shout out to him losing by 40 with the Raptors. That's not easy to do. I'm not watching this 2K tournament, but... yeah, anyway.
Damn.
Yeah, Masai maybe himself...
That's just, maybe that's just revenge.
Oh, wow.
Yikes.
Yeah, no, he's got to keep that beard on for a little longer after losing by 40. Yeah, Masai said about Pascal, quote, I will tell you honestly, when I saw Pascal in Basketball Without Borders in 2012, I couldn't even tell you he was an NBA player. That's how incredible his story is. And, you know, that's, again, this is the story with all of these guys. It's just, it was an incredible, that 2016 draft year was just incredible that summer for them in terms of talent. So Pascal joins the team. Rookie year, he ends up starting because Jared Sullinger, I think he gets hurt the first game, right? He like broke his foot playing against Kevin Durant, and that was the debut of Durant with the Warriors. This was in Victoria where the Raptors were holding training camp. All I remember from that game, aside from Sullinger's injury, was that, yeah, I mean, Pascal Siakam had a possession where he guarded Kevin Durant one-on-one and blocked him at the rim. And I was like, okay, all right, you got my attention. Forget this Al-Farouq community shit, all right? This guy's pretty, not that bad. And as a rookie, I thought he was actually okay. Like, he wasn't an effective player, but he had some skills. Like, yeah, definitely just incredible in transition. Most of his points were hit-ahead passes from Kyle Lowry. And he had a little bit of a baseline jumper, and the jumper didn't look that bad. And he didn't really have the range to shoot from three. He was only on the baseline, maybe 12, 15 feet, but... He had
He was playing that Rondé game in the offense, basically.
Actually, though, that was really it. He was Rondé who could hit layups, and it was like, all right, it's not bad.
It's a big skill for Rondae.
Listen, if Rondae could hit layups, man, probably playing center for the Houston Rockets. But yeah, I mean, you know, Pascal, it was not necessarily that exceptional rookie year. Like, you know, he started because Sullinger was hurt, and, you know, it was clear that the Raptors had a lot of ambitions that year, and they were not going to actualize those ambitions with Pascal as a starter. That year, they end up trading for Serge and PJ Tucker, so two power forwards. Well, I guess PJ was a small forward at the time, but still two power forwards at the deadline. And so, you know, it wasn't that memorable for Pascal, other than the D-League and the championship. So I'll ask you the same question about, you know, Pascal as I did about Fred. But what did Pascal work on in the D-League, and what did he show that he was capable of at that level?
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest contrast there was that what I thought I was seeing from Siakam over his 34 starts before he kind of got pulled from the starting lineup was a guy who did some things well but was really trying to fit his game to what the Raptors needed, and that was coming with some complications, right? Like, he didn't always look comfortable. He looked a little like he didn't know his role in the offense. Even defensively, like, I think he had in his head that he's supposed to be this energy guy and they have big things for him defensively. So he would be, like, scampering all over the place. And that was awesome sometimes, but also sometimes you were leaving guys, like, you were way out of position and stuff. But obviously that flashed a lot of potential. So I thought the biggest change from the NBA to the G League was he went from a guy trying to figure out what his role was and fit his game to a role to just, like, being himself again. And one thing that Stackhouse always liked to do with the 905 was, like, he loved running a post-oriented offense, which, coming from what Siakam was at New Mexico State, fit him really well. And then the big thing they did beyond just giving him more touches was they basically told him, if you come down with a defensive rebound, you don't need to find a point guard. Just go. And I think that helped him start to build the confidence in his handle and the confidence that, you know, in transition, he didn't have to just, like, run out ahead of everyone and be a play finisher. He could initiate, too. And, you know, you saw little glimpses of things, like the defense sharpened up a little bit and he made a couple nice passes and he hit. The funny thing is that I remember, like, people saying for a while, like, oh, he went down to the G League and like, he hit threes, and that was, like, a sign of thing to come. He absolutely did not go down to the G League and hit threes. He was, like, 7 for 25 or something like that.
Oh, okay.
In the G League. But, no, it was mostly just, you know, they went from you're trying to take this young, raw prospect and fit him to a small box because that's what you need in, like, this make-or-break season to just being like, you know what, go down and be yourself and expand your game and like, find out what you are. Don't try to fit this narrow role. Find out what your role is and where you're going to go. So I think, you know, I think that's been a credit of the Raptors' entire player development system is that they kind of go into it with this open mind a lot of the time in their summer programs and in the G League, is that, you know, you're not trying to develop Fred VanVleet to be a good third point guard or Pascal Siakam to be a good backup power forward. You're trying to develop these guys to see what they can become, and you don't kind of put these limits on what their roles are going to be. And I think that's, you know, that's the biggest thing Siakam flashed, and that confidence came back pretty quickly, where by the end of those 34 games starting, you know, there was his head hanging sometimes when he was getting that Luis Scola 6 minutes to start each half, and then you get the hook. And then by the time, you know, his 905 time was done, you know, the chess was back out and he was calling for the ball in key situations and he was yelling at Bruno and calling him some unkind words to try to fire him up. And so you saw that come back as he started to have success.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, this is one thing that you notice a lot with guys, but guys in the NBA, when they go down to the G League, like, you just see, like, an entire different side usually come out. Like, and when you watch some of the, like, when you saw what Pascal did at the NBA level in that year, his role was just so different than when he, if you watch some of the highlights, go back and watch, like, I mean, I don't know, just a weird recommendation, but look, listen, everyone's under quarantine. Go online, go watch the 2017 Pascal Siakam D League Finals mix, all right, the highlight mix. He was doing some of the same stuff he was doing now. The spin move, you know, like handling the ball, attacking the middle of the floor, explosive finisher and stuff like that. Like, it was it was really impressive. And you were seeing some stuff there that you weren't necessarily seeing. He wins, you know, D-League MVP. You know, it's a great time, stuff like that. But for the most part, rookie year, kind of quiet for Pascal. Really where it got going was same year as Fred, really, was the bench mob. And, you know, it was a little strange because I didn't think his game was going to translate as much to what the Raptors needed a lot of, because they needed a lot of three-point shooting and stuff like that. But What that year really showed me was just like the playmaking and the fact that he was really getting comfortable with handling the ball, triple handoffs, making a move, stuff like that. Yeah, it was really interesting, and you know, he started really flashing some signs in that season. What stood out the most to you about Pascal in that bench mob year?
Yeah, the playmaking is a big thing, and I think, you know, I think as we talked about kind of Nick Nurse-ifying the second unit offense that year, and part of that was the transition game was such a deadly weapon for that bench mob because they were so good defensively and because they couldn't really score in the half court that well, where, you know, when you get two point guards and Pascal flying up and down the court, that makes for some easy offense. But I think your point about the playmaking is right. You know, he had one game early in the year where he had five assists when they just like blew out the Knicks, and like toward the end of the game they were kind of like, yeah, you know, let Pascal run some of the offense here. And then later in the year he had a six assist game in a big blowout against Detroit, and then he had six assists in another blowout. So you kind of started to see there were these games where once the game was in hand, instead of just running out to, you know, running out your bench unit to just kill out the clock or whatever, they were making a concerted effort over time to put the ball in Pascal's hands more in the half court too, and he was running those pick and rolls and dribble handoffs and things like that. So obviously that was an overwhelmingly positive season for him overall, but yeah, I think that's the skill where, you know, you look at the last chunk of the season and, you know, here, I'll look it up in one second. Over the last 24 games, he's averaging 2.5 assists per game, and this is a guy who to that point had mostly been like a play finisher and a transition guy. So I think, you know, and we saw little glimpses of the spin move and stuff like that year, but it was really just a comfort level with the ball in his hands, and it's not, obviously running in transition off of a stop is not the same as operating in the half court, but your comfort level doing those things and how your handle looks is probably going to translate with that stuff. Now, obviously, that season, the other thing that stood out was that it was one of the worst three-point shooting seasons in NBA history.
Oh,
29 for 132. But I think it was encouraging, too, you know, that there was no point at which they told him to stop taking those or he shied away from taking them, which was, you know, it was painful sometimes in some weeks and some months. But obviously, you know, you look at where he went after that, that was a necessary part of the development, too.
I think it was like maybe January of that month of that season, but he had a whole month where he shot like 1 for 27 from three.
That's tough, man.
Yeah, but no, generally speaking, like a really good year. Like I thought he, you know, even on top of all this stuff, like some small stuff, like the playmaking, you know, him and Jakob Poeltl had a really good two-man game together. I made a YouTube compilation of them just like assisting each other. You know, I thought defensively that year also really showed what he could do too, just because he was able to sort of really like be the kind of passing guy that you see today with like filling all these gaps, making a lot of help rotations and stuff like that. He was impressive. I even thought like, oh, going into the playoffs, yeah, we're going to play the Cavs, fine. You know what? Pascal's probably our LeBron defender, like, you know, whatever. Didn't really work out that way, whatever.
Oops.
But yeah, I mean, the only strange thing about his sophomore year that I didn't find that impressive was that he kind of was not impressive in the playoffs. Like, obviously last year, Pascal was played a big role in the championship team. But, you know, in that playoff run, he was struggling with foul trouble all the time. I remember him getting, like, you know, outplayed by Mike Scott and a little by Markieff Morris. And then in the Cavs series, really didn't do that much, you know? And so that concerned me a little bit, but realistically, like, that was his first taste of the playoffs. His role was a hustle guy. Hustle guys in the playoffs generally don't do that well. No offense, you know.
Plus two, like we talked about with Fred, like, you lost the bench mob, right? Like, Fred wasn't playing, and then you can't play a five-man bench unit. Mm-hmm. And I think we talked about earlier, like, Fred's third year, where for some guys, the comfort level of that role certainty and the chemistry of who you're playing with is an important factor when you're so early on in your career. And, you know, that was kind of gone. And then, yeah, I mean,
yeah,
there were a lot of guys who didn't play super well in the playoffs that year.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah, I still have sometimes have nightmares about Serge Ibaka getting stripped by Kyle Korver at half court. That's one of the lowest moments I had as a Raptor fan. All right, so last season,
defensive stopper Kyle Korver though.
Oh my god! Yeah, we kept thinking Serge was gonna be the Kevin Love stopper too. That also did not work out. But it also wasn't CJ Miles either. So last season, you know, coming into the year, again, so Pascal has an incredible season. He's most improved. He goes in the, you know, eventually becomes a second option. But coming into the year, it wasn't even clear that he was going to be the starting power forward. Like, he had to battle out with OG throughout the course of training camp and preseason and stuff like that. And OG had a tough year, so, you know, it wasn't as much competition as you would think. But still, like, Pascal wins that spot, and he literally just takes it and runs with it. Like, it's one of the most impressive, most improved seasons, because you can see the improvement throughout the actual course of the year. Like, Pascal Siakam set his career high in scoring 7 different times in 1 year, culminating with 44 against Washington. Like, yeah, like, so for you, I guess, like, my question was, like, you know, when were you sort of comfortable and sort of assured that Pascal was going to be, at least in terms of offense, kind of like that second option?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a thing. I sat down with him in January and kind of wrote the, like, a pre-All-Star, like, okay, this guy's probably the most improved. What's at the root of this and stuff? And, you know, it was, I don't know. I don't have a good answer. Like I tend to be pretty slow to come around on, like, three-point sample. Like, I wanted to see a good sample of Pascal knocking down those corner threes before I was like, okay, he can hit that corner three. I was probably, I was probably more encouraged than average with the playmaking and stuff, because I thought the playmaking that we'd seen late in 2017-2018 was carrying over, and he was able to, you know, obviously a lot of his success was the games that Kawhi sat. But even when Kawhi was playing, he could kind of attack a broken down defense and get a dump off or a kick out or whatever. You know, that's something that stagnated a little bit this year. But I think that stuff was there. And then, I don't know, it was probably mid-season before I was like, this is legitimate and not just like a really hot start. Mm-hmm. The three-point shooting is there. Obviously, the spin move is something that, like, we had all come to kind of get familiar with at that point. But it takes a while, right? Like, you have to give it some time for the player to succeed and then the opponents to start adjusting to that and then see how that plays out. You know, the benefit of having Kawhi Leonard around was that teams couldn't really sell out to stop Siakam all the time. And then I think the big one was, I forget what game it was, but he hit the game winner where they basically let him ISO Phoenix. At the end of the game, right? Phoenix?
Yeah, it was an ugly game.
Yeah,
it had to end on a game winner against Phoenix.
Yeah, and like that's later in the season. Like that was January 17th, so that's probably later in the season than I actually think I started to, like, he had some monster games leading up to that Phoenix game too.
Yeah.
But that moment is kind of where it's like, okay, like he has the confidence to do that and the team has the confidence in him and he has that in his bag. So, I don't know, man, it was kind of a slow burn over the course of the year, but yeah, it was around, you know, it was in January where I already started writing, this guy's the most improved player and this is a crazy development story kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, he had some really good games throughout that course of that year. I think the one that was eye-opening for me was late November. The Raptors hosted Golden State, which I thought was actually the regular season game of the year. It was the Raptors prevailing in overtime by a score of 131-128. Kind of a finals preview. Kevin Durant played that game. Steph was out for this one. But they had Klay and KD. And KD went out for 51 against Kawhi, who had 37. But Pascal was really, really good in this game. He had 26 points. He had 2 rebounds and assists. He had 26 points on 8 of 10 shooting with 3 of 4 from 3. Got to the foul line 8 times. You know, and he was just doing things that just, like, I mean, it was really impressive that stretch where I think 3 different Raptors had blocked Kevin Durant in the first quarter. Pascal was one of them. And I've never seen Pascal, KD block on his jumper before. But it was just really impressive. Anyway, so yeah, Pascal really, you know, he had a lot of coming out moments in that year. He wins most improved player. Honestly, there was a little bit of debate, you know, at the end of the year, because, you know, you got to drum up some, you know, discussion around awards. And so it was like, maybe it's D'Angelo Russell who's doing a nice thing with the Nets, whatever. But Pascal ends up winning it by a landslide.
Man, that, could you imagine how that would look afterward if Russell had won? Like, even just looking at it right now?
Yeah.
Guy's been traded twice since then.
I was like, Russell's, he's good, and he did improve, kind of, but, like, I mean, it's nuts, man. Pascal went from 7 points a game to 17 points, and then, yeah, I mean, you know, I think throughout the playoffs, like, that was really impressive when you think back on it. I mean, he was really the number two option, and especially for someone who, you know, had improved this game so recently, had, you know, just stepped into that role later, so early in his career, like, the fact that he did that is, obviously, Kawhi was phenomenal, but, you know, if you look at it just, like, Kawhi plus Pascal Siakam's points, like, they had as many points in their playoff run last year as Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan ever had, which is, like, nuts, man. Yeah, so Pascal, against Orlando, he was legitimately elite, I thought. 23 points per game, 8 rebounds, 3 assists, 53% shooting. that game three that he had when Kawhi was sick and he had that flu game and he shot really poorly. Pascal, you know, ended up kind of closing that game out. He had a spin move against Evan Fournier that kind of sealed it. And game three was actually pretty important because it was the pivotal, like, swing game. There was only 1-1 at the time. And then, you know, really where he struggled was kind of against Embiid. He only shot 44% in that Sixers series. He averaged 19, but 44 was kind of low. And then against the Bucks, where he averaged 14 points per game on 40% shooting. But then he closed out strong in the finals, where he averaged 28-4 on 50% shooting.
Yeah, and this is kind of what I meant when I said earlier that, you know, sometimes development isn't linear, and sometimes it's not linear within a season or within a series, right? Mm-hmm. And we saw, you know, Siakam go, he starts as a rookie and then has to take a step back and go to the G League. And then he's great with the bench mob, but he also has one of the worst three-point shooting seasons of all time, and that's kind of a step back, and then he's not very good in the playoffs. And then he has his most improved player season, and then, oh, teams are game planning for you for 5-6 games at a time. And kind of with not uniformly within each series, but I feel like he struggled a little bit and then got better a couple times during the course of the playoffs. And obviously that's what's played out this season. But I think, you know, I think that's natural. I don't think anyone ahead of the season, and certainly back like earlier in his career, would have thought he would have been in the spot to be the team's number two scorer in a finals run. So, you know, it's the luxury of having Kawhi Leonard on your team and,
yeah, for sure,
you know, being as good as they were, that you could watch him go through those bumps and still not like obviously there were huge stresses in the playoffs, but I don't think at any point anyone was like, oh, Pascal Siakam is the reason that the Raptors aren't going to beat the Philadelphia 76ers. In fact, if I'm remembering right, Pascal's injury made everyone worry that they were going to lose to the 76ers. But yeah, I think that's one of the best playoff runs in terms of like watching a guy grow on the job and like really kind of come into his own at the right time by the time the Golden State series came around.
Yeah, I mean, you could say what if about so many moments in the playoff and in the title team, but man, if Pascal doesn't have this like breakout year, I don't even know what happens with the team. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
I mean, if you want to get more granular than that too, like if Pascal doesn't have the game one he has against Golden State, because like Lowry wasn't that good and Kawhi Leonard was kind of iffy, not iffy, yeah. He was iffy by Kawhi Leonard
him.
Standards.
They
yeah,
were doubling him super hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. And game one he has what? 32 points on like 15 of 17 shooting against Draymond. Wild.
Yeah.
Wild.
Yeah. Pretty good stuff.
For your first finals game, man. And of course, game six, he closes it out, 26 points. I still think it's super, you know, illuminating that, you know, in that 1-point game, the Raptors call timeout. They come out of that play and they run a Kyle Lowry, Pascal Siakam pick and roll. Lowry slips to Siakam. Draymond lunges and reaches and just was nowhere close, and Siakam kind of euro steps him, goes in for the little floater and ends up hitting it, and that was the last basket of the 2019 playoffs. So shout out Pascal. Damn. And I think really the best part about this is that, you know, okay, so Kawhi has left, but in that, you know, playoff run, you really got to learn so much about who you are as a player when the top teams in the NBA with the best players are gearing up specifically to stop you. And I think that really did help sort of inform what Pascal needed to improve upon, you know, in the offseason. Because, you know, when you thought about the Bucks series, what made that successful was they put a center on him, they dared him to shoot, they took away the corners, made him play at the top of the floor. He couldn't really do much with it. Same thing with Embiid. And I think that's where, you know, that was really helpful and instructive because, you know, that is exactly what Siakam worked on in the offseason. And, you know, we don't have the playoffs to see if it was going to translate at the highest level this year. And hopefully they come back, but you know, at least in the regular season, this season, we saw Pascal take that next step in terms of just, like, redesigning his entire game. That's the thing. When he was most improved, and as DeMar said, like, there's an argument to be made. I don't necessarily agree with it, but there's an argument to be made that Pascal is most improved again this year just because of how much more difficult his role was this year as compared to last year.
Yeah, that's always the toughest thing with the most improved award is that, you know, his leap was much bigger last year, but it's a tougher and more important leap that he's trying to take this year. And I'm with you. I don't think he's a most improved, like, I don't think he's the most improved player. But especially because, like, his efficiency has gone down and stuff like that. But I think if you're looking at long-term who Pascal Siakam is going to be, you know, even just adding the threat of that pull-up above the break three, and, like, the mid-range game isn't really there yet. I think both of us wrote about heading into the season that, like, hey, heads up, he's probably going to have to take more mid-range shots just because, like, that's what's going to be there sometimes when a defense is selling out to stop you. But the threat of that pull-up three is huge for, mm-hmm. for how teams are going to guard him in a playoff series, and I think it does probably take away some of the bigs who can guard him. You know, I still think Miami would put Bam on him probably, but I don't know, you know, I certainly don't think you're going to risk, like, a Brook Lopez on him anymore.
Yeah.
So I think that's a pretty fundamental skill addition for him. Now, other parts of his game have not come along as smoothly, but, like, overall, you have to be pretty overwhelmingly impressed with a guy taking another leap this big and you know, pushing almost 30% usage and being pretty good in that role. Asked an awful lot of him this year.
Yeah, no, they really did, man. And I thought the way he started the year was just, like, eye-opening to me. Like, first off, he opens the season on ring night with 34 points and 18 rebounds. Just incredible. I remember at the time, it was, like, right after he signed that max contract extension, people were like, is he really a max player? And it's like, yo, come on, what are we doing? And then, you know, in that first 27 games before he ends up suffering that groin injury against Detroit, which kind of, like, really dampened his year a little bit. But he was averaging 25 points, 8 rebounds a game, 4 assists, with the true shooting percentage around 58% when that injury was happening. Like, he was really good to start the year, especially when Kyle went down as well, Serge went down. Pascal and Fred, the two of them leading the team, you know, Pascal had to handle the ball a little bit more, obviously, you know, no clear third-string point guard. And, yeah, he was really impressive. And I just thought that, look, for a guy to, you know, in most improved season, he really thrived along the baseline, whether that was the corner three, whether that was in the post, whether that was going to the rim. Like, it was mostly, you know, that's where he thrived as a player. And this season, he's had to operate entirely differently. He doesn't get that much corner threes anymore. And he has to be at the top of the floor. He has to operate. He has to, you know, run more pick and roll than he's ever done in his life. Like, it's just, it's impressive to me. And so, you know, who knows if the season gets restarted or not. But, you know, I think, well, I mean, first off, would he be on an NBA, all-NBA team for you based on what he's done so far this year?
He's, like, he's right on the fringe for third team. Like, I don't think we have to discuss, really, second team or first team, ones that would escalate his contract. I think that there's, like, four or five forwards who have a case for that third team spot. I wouldn't argue with him being in there. Probably, like, if we're taking away, you know, the way people are going to vote on this, they're going to look at the overall thing. I don't think people are going to make room for the fact that Siakam was growing into this role.
Yeah.
And I think if you take away that, then he probably doesn't make it in. But if you have an appreciation for, you know, the amount of learning on the job and just the leap that he's taking, then yeah, you could put him on your third team. You know, I think if we saw the ballots right now, I probably don't think he gets on. I think he probably just misses. Just, like, the efficiency took too big of a dip from a true shooting percentage standpoint. And, like, the defense hasn't been quite as good as last year. And the assist rate hasn't come along. It just, you could make small nitpicks.
Yeah.
Where, like, but if you're watching it every day and you're seeing the difficulty of this role jump, obviously the appreciation level for it is significantly higher. So,
yeah, for sure. But I mean,
you know, I don't have a vote, so I haven't looked at in detail who's you know, who would be ahead of him or behind him or whatever. But
yeah,
I think he's got a fringe case for 13.
I'll just say this: like, obviously, yeah, I don't think he's gonna be one of the top four. If you, like, you got, you know, LeBron and Giannis first team, you got Kawhi and AD second team. Maybe AD goes to center, but I doubt it. He's played power forward most of the year. Lakers like to play big. And so I think the top four are kind of set. But, yeah, I mean, aside from that, I don't know, man. There's a group there for sure. Like, I think Tatum, she got a lot of love for it. You know, there's other players. But, I mean, I don't know, man. I mean, I think what's really going to work in Pascal's favor in terms of just, like, the drop deficiency and things like that you mentioned is just, like, the Raptors are third in the NBA. That's going to be a really positive factor. Yeah. And if they're not going to put Kyle on the All-NBA guard team, which I think that's more of a long shot, even though I think Kyle really has a discussion for that as well. I think Pascal, honestly, my prediction is Pascal makes 13 All-NBA.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with it. That's for sure.
He's basically had a very similar year as Blake Griffin did last year statistically. And it's sort of as a rule, too, as sort of that playmaking power forward type. Of course, Blake Griffin did it for, like, a Pistons team that was the 8th seed, and the Raptors overall have better talent, and obviously they're 2nd seed, but, you know, Blake Griffin had a 13 All-NBA last year, so.
Yeah, Blake Griffin's really good, too. Was really good. Rest in peace.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know that those knees are coming back. us.
Yeah, right? That's a shame, really. I really like Blake Griffin's career.
Yeah, me too, man. Yeah. He was, and like spending a couple years in Detroit, it's like, man, this guy's really going to be underappreciated.
Yeah. No, he went all out last year, and then he burned himself out. It's a shame. It's a shame.
I guess the big thing with Siakam, if we're projecting forward, is like the finishing's got to come back a little bit. Not that he's not finishing well at the rim, but he's gotten to the rim a lot less this year. He went from taking 46% of his shots at the rim to 40% to 29% over 3 years.
Yeah.
And if you finish at a 70% rate at the rim, that's a lot of efficient buckets that you've lost. And, like, his free throw rate hasn't come up with that. So, you know, that's I think, the next step of him. You talked about kind of how year three, he had kind of this horizontal baseline-oriented game, and now he's got kind of this vertical top-to-bottom game. And now you got to try to blend those together and just, you know, even like the floater range stuff that he normally feasts on, he wasn't as good at this year. I don't think any of that is like a point of concern. I think it's just a matter of putting the whole package together now and kind of just sharpening those reads a little bit of when you go into avoid contact versus invite contact and things like that.
Yeah. And it's also partly like managing energy and stuff. Like, it's just way easier to like be the energy kind of type player, especially earlier in his career, bench mob season, last season. This year, like, it's just so much more bodies on him, so many more people he has to beat. Everyone's focused on him a little bit more. He has to play more minutes, has to do more. Like, it's just, you could tell, like, there was a bit of a grind and a wear and tear on him as the year went on, which is, again, going to come when it's your first run as the number one guy. To cap off this segment on Pascal, I just wanted to focus on a couple other quotes that have come out. You know, I think Pascal, one of the things for him personally that I think he really sees as responsibilities, I think he feels a lot of responsibility to sort of change a lot of stereotypes about African players. And I think that even kind of directly, you know, leads to the nickname, the P skills kind of thing, because, you know, Siakam has said, quote, Masai and I have always had this conversation about making sure we change the culture. This is bigger than me. So first time I started playing basketball, I was a big man no matter what. I was tall. That's what you are. I always wanted to have the skills. I always wanted to work on these things. Now I can show kids and people from Africa that, hey, you can be more than a big man. You can have all the tools. And I think that's really cool because, again, like, just because, I mean, there's always been a lot of great African big men to have come out. Obviously, Hakeem, you know, I guess Siakam technically is a big, Embiid, you know, many others, Dikembe. But, yeah, for Pascal, he's kind of revolutionary in that way because you just don't see a lot of great, you know, African guards or even African wings. And for Pascal to, you know, have the game that he has, it really is kind of game-changing because it could really lead to sort of a next generation, a next wave of, you know, players coming from that continent.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I think obviously that's a great example to set. And I think it's also a good lesson to learn for the NBA at large of, like, I think too often we're guilty of boxing guys in before they're anywhere near fully developed, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like for Siakam to come in and you say, yeah, he could be this energy big type, you know, maybe he could be a bow outlaw type, a transition threat, whatever. It's fine to have those expectations and to have that as kind of a baseline. But thankfully, the Raptors didn't develop him as if that's the only thing he could be, right? They didn't only play him in that role. The 905 afforded him the chance to expand that. And I think that's something the Raptors have done well of, is not boxing guys in and kind of seeing what they can do in a larger development picture. So I think that, yeah, it's obviously a great example to people back in Africa that he wants to set. And I think it's a good lesson that the Raptors have made good use of. And I think maybe, you know, other teams will start to catch up on too, of like, don't let what a player is at this moment determine what he can be, right? It's like Masai, when I wrote about Pascal as a most improved player in January 2019, and I kind of was talking to him about some of this stuff and what drives him and, you know, his dad and being an influence in Africa and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he said that so many of his conversations with Masai over the years had come down to basically the question of why not? Like, why can't you be a guy that has the ball in his hand in transition? Why can't you be a guy that runs pick and roll even though you're a big man and stuff like that? So a lot of it came back to just why not? And I think that is a lot of Masai's worldview. Especially as it pertains to the continent. And then I think it's a lot of Pascal's worldview too. So I think they're a good match in that sense. And I think it's, you know, it's a good way to be as a person. I think it's a smart way to try to develop basketball players too.
Yeah, for sure. And you can tell he has tons of pride, you know, him and Masai especially. have, especially see that eye to eye kind of thing, you know, in terms of just like the game being bigger than basketball and your career is bigger than basketball. It's also the impact you can make and the doors you can open for other people. So I've always really respected that part about Pascal. And I also just thought that, like, you know, looking at his entire story, like, you know, he's just, for a guy who's at that level, especially in terms of that caliber of player, he doesn't really carry himself with the kind of attitude, not even just attitude, but just like the overconfidence and sort of the outsized personality that most superstars come with, right? I think Pascal really is, you know, still to his core, a very humble guy, very willing, a team player. I don't know. It's just something about his personality. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where he's just like, it's not, it's unique. It really is. He's, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of, you know, not taking anything for granted. And then I think there's probably like some level of self-satisfaction in being and having made it like this, despite people telling you you kind of can't. But like not also the, like the humility is not the right word, but to not like to have that influence your confidence, but not put a chip on your shoulder outwardly, you know, like right, obviously yeah. In the gym, he's got a chip on your shoulder, but that's a hard thing to do, to have something drive you and you feel incredibly proud about, you know, having done it and proven it. And that balance between, you know, that making you very confident but not arrogant mm-hmm. is a tough balance, I think. And I think, you know, I think it comes down to he's like, he strikes me as a pretty good person and a person that people like to be around and stuff. So, you know, I think that's probably just a part of his nature.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, it's super cool that, you know, he's surrounded, you know, by his brothers and stuff like that. And he's obviously been very close with his family. You know, he lost his father in the car crash. And, you know, that part is also very well chronicled. But, you know, the way he's close with his family and stuff like that, too, is just really cool. You know, like, I wish I could be working with my brother all the time and stuff like that. But I also don't want him to go into sports media, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm fine not working closely with my brothers.
So.
It's all right.
So there you go. I mean, the two guys from 2016 that have really gone from kind of fringe guys to becoming sort of the future of the Raptors. Obviously, you know, Fred has to re-sign and stuff like that and everything else. But, yeah, you know, like the Raptors have been incredibly blessed to have these two. So.
Now, do you want to break down what happened with EJ Singler and Drew Crawford and stuff since then too? Or
Oh yeah. Hit me. What happened to Danny Crawford's son?
Yeah, I don't know. I know EJ was playing Portugal for a little bit, but
okay, all right. Maybe yeah. Maybe you could teach Nick Nurse some Portuguese.
There you go.
Yeah. The best way to learn Portuguese is to play some pickup soccer. You'll learn all the swear words very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, my like where I'm from, it's a heavy Portuguese population in Cambridge, and my high school was like probably like 60-70% Portuguese, so I at least knew like Portuguese curse words and stuff.
Yeah. I won't say on the podcast, but
no,
I'll tell it to you after the call.
Like when Bruno first got here, I would ask him like, "Hey, how are you? Like, how was the game?" kind of stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty good.
But it's funny. He would always like tease me about how bad my Portuguese was, and I wanted to say back to him, like, it's the same level as your English, man. That's I'm trying here.
Wow.
I'm not very good at second languages. I'm not a...
I don't have that. Do you think Pascal also chirped him in Portuguese?
No, Pascal chirped him in English.
Yeah, well. unfortunately, at that point, Bruno understood English quite well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he would have. I think that would have been one of the first words he picked up, anyway. So
yeah, fair enough. So Blake, thanks for coming on the podcast. Seriously, thanks for devoting 2 hours. What are you gonna do with the rest of your day now that?
I don't know, man. I gotta finish up this article I was writing before this started, and then I'll probably work out or something, and then probably stare into the void and wait to restart the whole thing over again tomorrow. And you know, normal quarantine life.
Yikes.
Yeah, all right, it's all right, man. It'll be good. What about you?
I got a work call. I got to produce this podcast, and then I'm probably gonna go for a bike ride. I went for like a 2-hour bike ride. That was really nice. Biking is probably like the only way I feel completely safe going outside, because you can really avoid people, especially at night. Like I went for like a 2-hour bike ride on Saturday. Like I live like in the Junction, and I biked to like Bay Bloor and then came back and stuff.
You got like your reflectors and stuff on though, right?
Yeah. I actually even wore a backwards hat, which was
I was going to ask if they make helmets big enough, but I guess that's asking too much.
They definitely don't. I actually went in to try to get a helmet once, and they were like, yeah, they tried like four or five on, and they're like, you know what? You just have an Asian head shape, and we don't have Asian helmets. And I was like, what does that mean? But then I looked it up, and apparently...
Wait, they actually said that?
Yeah, and I was like, yo, what does this mean? I was like, I was almost slightly offended, but then I looked it up, and it's like, it's really true. There's like, apparently it's just like the shape of the skull. It's like, one's more round, and one's more oblong. And so all it right. wouldn't really fit. Anyway, I don't know. That was their explanation. Also, they were like, your head's big as hell. Like, I don't know what to do, man.
Yeah, that explanation makes sense to me. So, I don't know about your background playing into it, but the size of that thing, yeah.
Yeah, no, I looked it up, and apparently it's real. So, yeah. So I hope everyone out there stays safe, and especially if you're in a position to do so, stay home. You know, be careful. Take this thing very seriously. And, you know, while you're home, make sure you read everything Blake writes and listen to Raptors Reasonablists. Anything else to plug, Blake?
No, man. The Athletic, all that said. The Athletic has 90-day free trials if you've ever, like, wanted to check the stuff out and not wanted to commit. 90-day free trials right now, so.
Yeah.
There you go. Check that out, finally.
You hear
read,
that?
Read about a bunch of old school stuff because there's nothing new going on.
You hear that, Alex? It's free for 90 days. It's time to hop on, man.
Yeah, Alex and I were joking that we were going to do, like, one of those IG Live rapper battles and producer battles.
Oh,
and we would just, please. Like, we were just going to read our articles back and forth to each other. But, like, Alex is going to come with drops of, like asking Siri to sign into The Athletic, but he uses your login and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's honestly been, like, 4 years of him using... Because I signed up to The Athletic because of you. Because I was like, I got to read Blake. So I signed up immediately.
But, are you going to cut this from the podcast, or am I going to record this later? And
No. You can take this to your bosses and run with it, you know. But yeah, that's how long Alex has been mooching. So thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to Blake, again, super generous with his time. And yeah, I'll be back next week with another super in-depth episode on another Raptors personality. I don't know who it is yet, but it's probably going to be like Masai or something like that, so.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.